Robin Mazahari, Washington, D.C.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, just like everyone else. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Iron English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and so obviously, what do I mean by just like everyone else? So just like everyone else is, no matter what our rank, our position, our background, we don't sort of try to get special privileges for ourselves, and we don't try to draw attention to ourselves. So that means we do the same things as everyone else, no matter our rank. And, you know, what can I say? So there's so many different instances, especially from the lives of our martyrs. And obviously, this would also apply, for example, talk about the life of the Holy Prophet, all the prophets, the Imams. But I'll just start with maybe talking about the lives of our martyrs. So one story, and this is something that one of my friends told me, and I'm for sure many people have heard of this, that, for example, one of the martyrs, not of the... Well, also of the, obviously had also served in the Holy Defense, but then was martyred just 5 years ago. So Shahid Soleimani, it's actually said of him that obviously, even though he had this very high rank, of course, he would also travel on public transport. So, you know, this is for people in the West, this would be very unusual. How can someone with such a high rank, such a position, just, you know, get to travel on a local bus? And this is something that we wouldn't see, to be honest, with someone of that rank in the West. So people in sort of high military posts would sort of always come in, almost in a cortege, a whole group of many different vehicles and bodyguards and you name it. So, you know, this is, what is this about? Well, a lot of this is about humility and not wanting to stand out and just wanting to live and be like everyone else, every other member of public. Welcome back to A to Z. Here on I'm Being Betrayed with my sister Zainab, and I'm talking about this idea of people who are extremely humble, regardless of their rank. So even if they have a very high rank, I just mentioned Shahid Soleimani, who would even travel on public transport. And you know, obviously this means that, no, why would we want to stand out? And there's also an example from the life of not one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, but a martyr of national service, former president of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Shahid Raisi, who was taking, applying to take to do a PhD program, and like everyone else, just rocked up on the day to take the entrance exam. So just sat in part of the huge hall where all the PhD candidates take the entrance exam, and just like everyone else. And I think some of the other people maybe recognized him or wondering how come he's sitting in the same exam hall taking this exam. But, you know, this is the way it is, that, you know, obviously we're not meant to sort of take these sort of special privileges. And, you know, what does that mean for us, behaving like everyone else? And obviously this and maybe in some countries is more pronounced, this idea that once we achieve a certain rank, you know, we sort of remove ourselves maybe a little bit from the general public, and we become, and I'm deliberately using some of these words, we are cosseted, we are separated, you know, we are actually treated as if we're special, as if we're different. But obviously in Islam, this is the quality of humility. This is something that should really feed into how we conduct ourselves on a daily basis. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Iran Radio presents some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The word Bismillah appears 114 times in the Quran. It occurs twice in chapter An-Naml, whereas chapter Tawbah is the only surah which does not begin with Bismillah. Quran believes in life after death, and the Quran teaches us that besides having a body, a human being also has a spirit, a soul. And when a person dies, the physical body vanishes, while the soul remains. We start this hour's lineup with leaders' speech. The program presents a selection of the statements and speeches of the honorable leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Then it's time for a spotlight. The program covers the most important events happening in the world today with roundtable analysis and discussion. And our final program this hour is our varied radio productions feature.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Some statements by Imam Khamenei about martyrdom, March 16th, 2019. One's endeavors in the way of God cannot be rewarded and compensated with anything worldly. Allah of the Exalted says, Allah has purchased of the believers their lives and their possessions. For theirs in return is the heavens, paradise. They fight in His cause and slay and are slain. The Holy Quran, chapter 9, verse 111. What is offered to you in return for jihad in the way of God, and what Allah of the Exalted grants in return for laying down your life and offering your possessions, is paradise and divine satisfaction. What we grant, including our verbal and nonverbal gratitude and the medals of honor, orders, and epaulets that we grant, are things which are noteworthy on the basis of worldly calculations. But on the basis of spiritual and divine calculations, they are not noteworthy. On the issue of martyrdom, what is important is that one becomes ready to sacrifice his life on the path to God. All our self-sacrificing soldiers who were prepared to lay down their lives enjoyed this virtue. But sometimes Allah the Exalted particularly favors some individuals by rewarding them with martyrdom in cash. So the value of such individuals increases several times because they receive the rewards of such jihad in cash. Allah has purchased of the believers their persons and their goods. For theirs in return is the garden of paradise. They fight for His cause and slay and are slain. A promise binding on Him in truth through the law, the gospel, and the Quran. The Noble Quran, chapter 9, verse 111. In other words, Allah of the Exalted accepted the commodity of martyrs, their lives and their persons, and has rewarded them directly with paradise in exchange. That is the best deal and the best profit. Our life is a resource which will be lost in any case, whether we want it or not. There is no person who can preserve this life, which is their most valuable resource. It exists for a while, and then it will be taken from us. This outcome happens in various ways. A person gets into an accident, for example, in the desert or on the streets, and they die like so. Another person dies of some disease, but another person bargains with God. They trade this perishable life with God. Before the revolution, I used to frequently add that martyrdom is a merchant style of death. It is a calculated death. A person who is martyred on the path of God is actually making the best kind of calculation. This is because our life is not something eternal.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
To fly. true day, a new way, the feeling that's already beside, the faith in our hearts will always rise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The European E3, as they were called, France, the UK, and Germany, initiated the snapback mechanism last month to reimpose nuclear-related sanctions on Iran. This provision was part of the 2015 UN Security Council Resolution 2231, which culminated in the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, a plan of action where Iran was to give unprecedented access to its peaceful nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. Iran did its part. The rest of the parties involved, though, failed to do theirs, starting with the U.S., who abandoned the deal altogether in May of 2018. Yet the Europeans have put the blame on and are seeking retribution against Tehran for non-compliance, just as Iran has entered into a new cooperation framework with the International Atomic Energy Agency, a fresh arrangement that Iran says it will immediately abandon should the Europeans insist on this unjust and coercive strategy or gamble. And this is a topic of our Spotlight program. But first, for our guests. Joining us is John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Fredericton, Canada. And Reza Vedadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. Gentlemen, pleasure to have you both on. Reza, we're going to start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well there, pal, in the UK. So what do we make of the JCPOA signatories, the E3? Iran says they failed to do enough toward the deal's preservation and function initially to even be able to speak of non-compliance and reimposition of sanctions. Your initial thoughts on this?
As you know, we've discussed this issue several times together on this show. And it's something that the Europeans are utilizing to try and align themselves possibly with the hawkish side of the United States foreign policy, and to try and appease the Israelis. As we know that, you know, there's a genocide taking on Israel, and the Europeans have done everything to assist in this genocide. They haven't done anything to prevent it. So now they are using the last kind of card that they have, the last card up their sleeve, to try and appease that side of this conflict between the Iranians and the Western side. So I don't believe that they're going to get much out of it. The sanctions that will be reimposed are not economic sanctions. There's no way they can implement these sanctions. They weren't able to implement them 10 years ago. Now that Iran is much more powerful country with its powerful navy, the navy has increased, developed a lot in the last 10, 15 years. It's very difficult for them to try and impose any of these sanctions. The only thing they're trying to use this is to impact Iranian economic psychology, to try and put pressure on the Iranian economic scene to, you know, increase the rate between the Toman, the Rial, and the dollar, and cause that kind of hardship to the people. But other than that, there isn't much more of this sanction. If it's implemented, if the Russians and Chinese don't prevent it from being implemented, can do to the Iranian country.
And when we say the last card, Reza, that the Europeans are playing, it's funny that they don't take a step back and see how it's worked out for the U.S. When the U.S. has been on a full-blown mode, coming when it comes to Tehran, ratcheted up full sanctions and pressure to try to get Iran to come screaming or crying to the negotiation table on its knees, it always basically got the opposite. And the Europeans, when they showed a little bit more autonomy and diplomacy, they seem to have gotten farther with Tehran in the past. Why they would choose to ditch that for trying to ramp up pressure on Tehran thinking that they'll be more conducive to some kind of positive outcome, it boggles the mind in some respects.
I mean, you're right. Absolutely, logically, when you think about it, it doesn't make sense. But I think if we look at it in the context that are they doing it to appease someone else, to try and show favor with another person, then it makes sense. Other than that, it's literally the last card they have. And Iranians have stated to them that if you use this mechanism against Iran, from now on, you will not even be discussed. You will not be in the room. You will not be part of any negotiations that take place between Iran and possibly the United States. So they've kind of sidelined themselves. And I think they knew that they were going towards that direction. They were like a third wheel, that they weren't assisting in anything during the sanctions when during the JCPOA, when United States left and imposed the maximum pressure during Trump's 2018 first regime. Initially they were discussing about having a mechanism that will provide Iran with economic relief, but that never took place. So they've always been a soft, good cop to the America's bad cop, but their agenda and their aim has always been the same as the United States.
And the Iranian leadership has said this, and they call this narrative and trajectory unfortunate and proof, to your point, the Europeans are compromised by the U.S., have abandoned diplomacy, and that this gamble will not pay off if they will achieve through pressure, that think that they'll pay, achieve through pressure what they failed through diplomacy and illegal attacks against the country. Do you think they are optimistic, the Europeans, that they'll achieve something this time around with this pressure tactic against Tehran? And if so, what do you think that objective or that outcome from their perspective may be?
No, I think they knew that Iran would not accept the restrictions. The three conditions they put was to have access to the sites that were bombed, access to Iran's enrichment and restriction on enrichment and all other facilities. Basically, they want to find out what damage the attack, the 12-day attack, achieved, and what other attacks need to be conducted. So it's more of a espionage information gathering tactic, and I'm pretty sure they knew that Iranians would never accept these conditions. So I think they thought, okay, if their snapback is going to expire, I think in about a month's time or less, let's at least use that. So then, we believe the sanctions will come back, and then we can utilize those leverages in a different way on Iran, which we'll see how it will work out.
And let's lay out the timeline for this for our viewers to see the absurdity into it, Reza. Maybe you could help us out with this. So last month, France, Germany, and the UK, they triggered the snapback mechanism. Why? Because they say that Iran refused to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency in allowing their inspectors to visit bombed nuclear sites by the U.S., which is ironic because Iran firmly believes that it was compromised intelligence that was given to the adversaries of the country by the IAEA that resulted and it's beyond nefarious and ridiculous to allow the IAEA immediate inspection against at those sites. And then, but still, even with 2 weeks after that, Iran started speaking to the IAEA to try to reengage diplomatically and come up with a new framework, considering of obviously that the attacks are going to result in a new framework of understanding between the two.
I mean, the fact that they also did not condemn something that is in international law classified as an illegal, extremely illegal act, whereby attacking a nuclear facility, a peaceful nuclear facility by another state, by another country, by another military, is against all international protocols or international laws or international norms of conduct. And we saw how they made a big deal when, I think a year or so ago, they were saying that the Russians are attacking a nuclear power plant that was in the territory of the Ukrainians during this conflict that they have. And they were up in arms about that. And yet the UN Security Council, the UN, and the IAEA did not condemn United States and Israel for what it has done. So even if we say that they did not conduct espionage, which we know they have, Iranians have the proof of that, and it's evident everywhere. And also the fact that when there was negotiations between the IAEA during the Trump negotiation period, the IAEA head, Grossi, would visit Israel and then visit Iran, or visit Iran and then visit Israel. Why is this person visiting Israel? For what reason is the head of the IAEA has any reason to visit Israel other than it's reporting to Israel? So there's many reasons why Iran should not be dealing with the IAEA on a fair footing.
Thank you. And joining us also Mr. John Bosnich from Fredericton, Canada. John, good to have you. Thanks for your patience there, pal. Now, the IAEA, John, seems content on building on this new arrangement to sit with Tehran and carve out a new understanding, an understanding that has to take into account the U.S.-Israeli aggression, obviously, a fact that took place as talks were underway diplomatically, the fact that the IAEA shared info about Iran. I was just sharing with Reza, I don't know if you heard us, whether deliberately or unknowingly, with those who attacked the country. Can the Europeans realistically, John, expect this not to impact Iran's cooperation with the IAEA and even with them moving forward?
Well, if the Europeans were what we could call adult, mature nations, no, they couldn't accept these conditions, but they are not. We have to remember that the European nations are basically military colonies of the United States and of the broader Anglo-American empire. And so these colonies are called upon to vote in favor of things that are given to them for rubber stamping by the United States. They are not called upon to take a position against the United States or against their trainers in England who bring them there with their Rhodes scholarships to teach them how to run an empire. This is a complete facade. These organizations, the UN, the Security Council, when it's not under proper control, the IAEA, all of these organizations are velvet gloves pulled over the mailed fist of the American empire to make it look like there's an international consensus that they represent. They do not represent any kind of an international consensus. They are pillaging and raping this planet, and they are bombing, pulverizing any states that stand up for their national sovereignty.
Thank you there, John. And Reza, can you please weigh in on this? Can the Europeans expect this year's chain of events against Iran not to impact Tehran's future cooperation with the IAEA, which is today in a preliminary stage of a new form of establishment, and that Iran has guaranteed will end immediately should there be a reimposition of sanctions? And does that even matter for them, that this little bit of hope and glimmer of cooperation with the IAEA and Tehran will be null and void should the snapback go through?
We have to bear in mind that the pressure that Iran was under 10 years ago when it accepted to sign the JCPOA and have those extreme restrictions put on it by IAEA and the UN and the Western bloc are non-existent now. Iran is a much more powerful country. It has had 10 years to prepare and strengthen itself against the sanctions that has been imposed. Because don't forget, once the United States left, it imposed its unilateral sanctions and forced other countries, other than the countries like China and Russia and other countries that deal with Iran now, to maintain sanctions on Iran. So it was never like, you know, sanctions were completely removed after 2015. And we have to bear in mind that Russia and China are much more powerful countries economically and military and politically right now. And they are more at odds with the United States and the Western bloc. 10 years ago, Putin, the 2022 attack in Ukraine hadn't taken place. And, you know, President Putin still wanted to try and have some kind of relations with the United States and the West. He still wanted to join that kind of sphere of influence. And China's economy, even though it was strong, wasn't as strong as it is now. And it was more reliant on the United States economy. But now the Chinese economy is less reliant on that. Politically and militarily, they're more powerful. We saw only a week ago the Chinese displayed new high-tech military equipment that they have. So it's a complete different world from 10 years ago, from a decade ago. And Iran and Russia and China have already gave a letter to the UN Security Council stating that this snapback is illegal and politically motivated. So I think Iran is much better positioned than it was 10 years ago to, I don't want to say whether the sanctions, if they're imposed, but to manage and deal with the situation that arises in the next week, which we'll see how it will work out. Don't forget, next, I think Security Council presidency goes to Russia. So that will have a big impact on how they will deal with it after the Koreans who are the president at the moment.
Good point. And John, now the Europeans, do you think they feel they can, through the snapback mechanism and activating, get a sweet deal? Iran says that will never happen, that the JCPOA, which was the best deal that they could have asked for, and that they ditched it. Iran stuck around for another year and a half, giving the E3 a chance to deliver, where the U.S. basically abandoned the deal. They ruined it, and even renewed efforts at diplomacy. You saw how that ended up with attacks against the country. So what do you think the E3 hopes to achieve, John, and what do you think they will actually achieve with this strategy of pressure and activating the snapback?
Well, first of all, the Europeans hope to achieve the satisfaction of their master, because they are slaves to the Anglo-American Empire, especially to America, and they've been on the receiving end of Trump's new tariffs and his new sanctions, and they want their societies to survive, they want their economies to thrive, and they know that they have to do what they're being forced to do by America. So what they want to do is please their master. What they should do is be morally correct, serve their God. They pretend to be believers in God. They should tell the truth. They should defend the fact that Iran supported and followed the JCPOA to the end until America canceled it. They should recognize the fact that Iran has been allowing inspections properly and has been following these rules. And they should come to grips with the fact that they have a complete, unfair, untenable, and indefensible bias toward Israel, who has multiple nuclear weapons and to whom they make no pressures, no construct of sanctions or punishment whatsoever. This is not the way the world can be run, with one law for one side and a totally different law for the rest of the world. Those colonial days are over.
And I'm glad you mentioned those colonial days, because it seems like time and again, Reza, we end up here often with these Western players. Now, the snapback will reimpose an arms embargo on the country, a ban on uranium enrichment and reprocessing, a ban on activities with ballistic missile capabilities, among other restrictions. Basically, a slew of sensitive issues that Iran has time and again called red lines, and that will really just lead to an impasse in negotiations, in talks, and hostile diplomacy. So what is the point in beating this dead horse, Reza?
Well, as my colleague said, they are answering the call of their overlord and master. And we saw how they had to sit in front of Donald Trump as if there was naughty little schoolboys who were getting told off by him, you know, when they went a couple of months ago or a couple of weeks ago when they were there. So the Europeans have completely sold their sovereignty after the Second World War to the United States. And their economies and their elite are so intertwined with the elites of the United States that it's very difficult for them to be independent and to be sovereign on foreign policy. And we can see this not only just with Iran, but most of other foreign policy issues. They align so much with each other when it comes to China, when it comes to Russia, and all other countries. So I generally think that if someone who lives in the UK, someone who lives in European countries, can see the state of the country, that the countries are literally physically falling apart, their national health service is falling apart, the roads are falling apart, and yet they are hell-bent on spending money on a war in Ukraine, hell-bent on creating new enemies in West Asia with Iran and other countries, instead of negotiating, dealing, and securing better prospects for their citizens. It just goes to show that the elite that are in power do not care about the citizens or the actual countries. They're answering to the cabal that really runs the West.
And before we wrap it up, I'm going to ask you, what we should brace for as we move forward. So, John, Iran said it will use any basically tools at its disposal to ensure that this will be as costly for the Europeans as possible, that they cheated Iran with the JCPOA. And are cheating Iran now with this illegal and unrealistic expectation. Are we to brace for a new era, John, of hostility and tits for tats that will absolutely get us nowhere between Tehran and the Europeans?
Unfortunately, that's what Israel wants. And what Israel wants is pressured upon Donald Trump through the Israel lobby that paid for his election. And they certainly have him under pressure. And so Israel wants it. Their imposed president in the United States, Donald Trump, not to say that Biden wasn't working for Israel also, but Trump was more willing to do what Israel demanded. So he is now the president of the United States. And now he has to decide whether Donald Trump is going to be the president of the United States or just another shill for the Israel lobby like so many in the past. That's a question for him personally, and he has to look himself in the mirror every day and decide whether he just wanted to work in the White House as a hired hand or if he wanted to actually be the president of the United States.
And Reza, we have a little bit of time left. Your ultimate and final thoughts, please. The Tehran and the Europeans, how do you see this unfolding moving forward? Best case and worst case scenarios, please.
Best case scenario is they don't encourage another conflict, another war with Iran. Iran continues to negotiate with the global south, increases economy and strength, so forth. Worst case scenario is they will, you know, instigate another war using Israel. Israel is the rabid attack dog of the United States and the Europeans. It's the colonial outpost, the project. And so that attack will then probably bring forward the earlier demise of the Israeli regime.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to the both of you. Mr. John Bosnich there, journalist, activist, and political, you bet, political analyst joining us from Fredericton, Canada, and also Reza Vedad, the academic researcher and author, joining us from London, the United Kingdom. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Heroes of the 8-year Holy Defense. The first of the Iranian month of Mehr that fell on September 22nd in 1980 was the day on which, without any provocation, Saddam of the repressive Ba'ath minority regime of Baghdad, on the orders of the U.S., launched a full-scale ground, sea, and aerial invasion of the Islamic Republic of Iran in a bid to seize the oil-rich border lands and to overthrow the dynamic system of government established by the sage of the age, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon his soul. The elaborate plots of the invaders soon went awry when Iranian Muslims, on the instructions of the father of the Islamic Revolution, rallied to the war fronts to stage epics and blunt the full-fledged aggression, although the war dragged on for 8 years because of tens of billions of dollars poured into Saddam's coffers by his Arab reactionary backers and accomplices, mainly Saudi regime and the regime in Kuwait, as well as the military hardware provided to him by global arrogance led by the great Satan, the U.S. Please stay with us for the first part of a new daily series on the occasion titled Heroes of the Holy Defense. There brilliant epics in the history of every nation in view of the resolve of the people to offer self-sacrifice for defending the honor of their country and religion. Without the least doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one such nation which, infused by the grassroots movement of the people at a time when the world was divided between capitalist West and the communist East, gained victory with the slogan, "Neither East nor West, Islam is the best." The U.S. and its accomplices viewed the emergence of a strong, independent, and Islamic Iran as a danger to their vested interests in the region and hatched a wide variety of plots in a bid to overthrow the Islamic Republic system of government. They backed the anti-revolutionaries and terrorists of all hue and color by attempting to spread seditions and separatist currents in some border provinces, such as Kurdistan and Khuzestan. Their plots, however, failed thanks to Iran's committed youths that got together to form the Basij Mobilization Forces and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps for the defense of the country and to safeguard the achievements of the Islamic Revolution at a time when the regular armed forces were being purged of officers influenced by the U.S. and the enemies of Islam and Iran. These popular forces, after defeating the seditious and separatist moves, fully displayed their commitment and religious national aspirations by enacting epics throughout the 1,200-kilometer-long border with Iraq to defeat the armed-to-the-teeth Ba'athist war machine. The memories of these immortal heroes who sacrificed their limbs and life are alive today. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rightly hailed these heroes of Islam and Iran, since jihad is one of the basic tenets of Islam. The late ideologue of the Islamic Revolution, martyr Ayatollah Murtaza Mutahhari, had said in this regard, "Islam is not a religion that says if someone slapped your face on the right, offer the left to him for another slap. It considers defense of faith necessary, and as is evident in the Holy Quran, in order to safeguard faith, one should either migrate from that land, or if he has the means, should organize jihad against the devilish forces." Thus, in view of these facts and as per the dynamics of Islam, Iranian youths not only rallied to the front for liberating the occupied parts of their homeland from the Ba'athists, but for defending their faith and revolution embarked on efforts in various fields to make the country self-sufficient. One of the leading defenders of the country on the battlefield was Dr. Mustafa Chamran. He undoubtedly remains one of the immortal heroes of the Holy Defense. Born into a religious family on March 8, 1932 in Tehran to Hassan Chamran Savoji, who was originally from Chamran village of Save, after completing his preliminary studies, he graduated from Tehran University's College of Technology in the field of electromechanics. After a year's teaching, he won scholarship for higher studies in the U.S., where he obtained his Ph.D. in electrical engineering and plasma physics in 1963 from the University of California, Berkeley. Parallel to his scientific and academic pursuits, Chamran was active in the political and social fields as a person who from his youth was a committed Muslim, having been one of the first members of Tehran University Students Islamic Society. In the U.S. also, he founded many revolutionary societies and organizations such as the Iranian Students Society, the Iranian Students Islamic Society, and Islamic Society of Muslim Students. He worked for a while at one of the NASA-related research centers in the U.S. named Bell Laboratory, where he was active in the field of satellites, guided missiles, and three-dimensional. Because of his political activities against the despotic Pahlavi regime, his work in the U.S. was cut short, forcing him to go to Egypt, where he obtained guerrilla warfare training for 2 years. In 1965, he went to Lebanon and became a prominent assistant to Imam Moussa Sadr. He helped found the Movement of the Deprived and then the Amal organization for fighting the Zionist entity. The third phase of Dr. Chamran's life started after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He returned after 21 years of life abroad and put his scientific and revolutionary experiences in the service of the country. He strove to groom the first group of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Then, as Deputy Prime Minister for Revolutionary Affairs, he bravely embarked on nullifying the anti-revolutionary plots. His unforgettable epic in organizing resistance in the city of Parver in Kurdistan is legendary. One of the missions entrusted to him by the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, was to free the army and popular forces from the siege of anti-revolutionaries in Parver. He admirably discharged his duties and liberated Parver. The Imam appointed him the Minister of Defense, and he spared no efforts for organizing the country's defense. Dr. Chamran was not seeking power, wealth, and fame. For this reason, on the outbreak of the Iraqi war, he went to the war fronts to set up irregular war headquarters in Ahwaz, the capital of Khuzestan province, for countering the Ba'athist army. Dr. Mustafa Chamran succeeded in preventing the advance of the Ba'athists, and in some regions he managed to drive them back. This well-known soldier of Islam was finally martyred in one of his missions on the battlefield and gained his cherished wish of martyrdom in the path of God. Imam Khomeini, in a message on the occasion of martyrdom of Dr. Chamran, said, "Chamran spent a lifetime from start to end with a grand divine purpose and a pure and untainted ideology without attachment to any political groups and bands. His life was dedicated to gaining the light of divine knowledge and earning proximity to God, and he strove on that path and sacrificed his life for it. He lived and died in honor. May his soul be joyous and may he be always remembered."
See her husband die.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. By the way, you're listening to Iran Radio. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. We'll start this hour's program with a viewpoint. The program offers an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of Islamic world today. And we round up this hour's program with A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran as well as inspirational poetry and stories.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. We have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom.
My name is Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Brother Muhammad, okay, Brother Muhammad. Yeah. How can I call you? Okay. Brother Muhammad and Shaykh.